Welcome to St. Louis on the Air and happy day before Christmas. I'm Don Marsh. A holiday departure today as we hope to get you in the Christmas spirit. We've taken some of your holiday memories and put them together for all to share. We'll be hearing a favorite Christmas poem and some verse reflecting on what this holiday should be all about. Sometimes some of us forget, but we shouldn't because this is truly the most wonderful time of year. You have just listened to the Ambassadors of Harmony, the St. Louis-based award-winning barbershop chorus, and the most wonderful time of the year. Director, Jim Henry, music professor at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. The most wonderful time of the year, and we're going to be talking about that a lot during the course of the day today. You know, since 1897, I think it was, kids of all ages have been reading an editorial in the old New York Sun. The title of that editorial, Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus. Most people know where that comes from. Children have asked that question, is there really a Santa Claus? 8-year-old Virginia O'Hanlon put the question to her father, and he suggested that she ask editors at the New York Sun newspaper, saying, if you see it in the Sun, it is so. Well, she wrote to the Sun. Editors wrote back, immortalizing her question and their response.
Virginia, your little friends are wrong. They have been affected by the skepticism of a skeptical age. They do not believe except what they see. They think that nothing can be which is not comprehensible by their little minds. All minds, Virginia, whether they be men's or children's, are little. In this great universe of ours, man is a mere insect, an ant, in his intellect, as compared with the boundless world about him, as measured by the intelligence capable of grasping the whole of truth and knowledge. Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus. He exists as certainly as love and generosity and devotion exist, and you know that they abound and give to our life its highest beauty and joy. Alas, how dreary would be the world if there were no Santa Claus. It would be as dreary as if there were no Virginias. There would be no childlike faith then, no poetry, no romance to make tolerable this existence. We should have no enjoyment except in sense and sight. The eternal light with which childhood fills the world would be extinguished. Not believe in Santa Claus? You might as well not believe in fairies. You might get your papa to hire men to watch all the chimneys on Christmas Eve to catch Santa Claus, but even if they did not see Santa Claus coming down, what would that prove? Nobody sees Santa Claus, but that is no sign that there is no Santa Claus. The most real things in the world are those that neither children nor men can see. Did you ever see fairies dancing on the lawn? Of course not, but that's no proof that they are not there. Nobody can conceive or imagine all the wonders that are unseen and unseeable in the world. You tear apart the baby's rattle and see what makes the noise inside, but there is a veil covering the unseen world which not the strongest man, or even the united strength of all the strongest men that ever lived, could tear apart. Only faith, fancy, poetry, love, romance can push aside that curtain and view and picture the supernatural beauty and glory beyond. Is it all real? Ah, Virginia, in all this world there is nothing else as real and abiding. No Santa Claus? Thank God he lives, and he lives forever. 1,000 years from now, maybe 10 times 10,000 years from now, he will continue to make glad the hearts of children.
Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus, as read by our own Shelley Curley of St. Louis Public Radio. Some other members of our staff have also been active in looking back at their own Christmas memories. Steve Potter, among them, he has a favorite memory of figuring out how Santa Claus manages to deliver just so many presents.
Both my parents grew up in St. Louis County, but I went to grade school in Toronto, Canada, and then later, Middletown, New Jersey. Every Christmas season, my parents, myself, my brother, and my three sisters returned to St. Louis for the holidays. We first spent Christmas Eve at my dad's parents, and we had the traditional dinner and open presents. Then the next day on Christmas afternoon, we drive to my maternal grandmother's house and enjoy another traditional dinner and another evening of presents. Well, Santa Claus was very generous, but I never understood how he went to both places. I wondered that for several years, but then I finally figured it out. One Christmas day, after leaving my grandparents in Normandy and driving down Hanley Road in the station wagon to Mimi's house on South McKnight for a second celebration, we spotted someone dashing between two houses. It just wasn't anyone. It was Santa, in full costume, carrying a huge red bag that was stuffed to the brim. Well, we didn't see Santa's sleigh that day, but we saw him. And at that moment, I thought to myself, so that's how he does it. I remember it like it was yesterday.
Now, a recollection from one of our listeners, Tricia Hendricks. She's a listener from Baldwin. She has a favorite holiday memory of unity and of stealing cookies.
Every year, my mother makes about a dozen different types of Christmas cookies for our family's enjoyment, but also to give as gifts and serve at holiday functions. When my three siblings and I were kids, she had to hide them or we would have finished them off way before Christmas. She'd lock them in the storage room in our garage and then hide the key somewhere in the house. The four of us would hunt for the key whenever home alone or when my mother was occupied and distracted. Eventually we'd find it and go and stuff a few cookies in our mouths in the cold of the garage before returning the key to its hiding spot. Then we'd wait and see how long it took her to realize we'd gotten into the stash and hide the key somewhere else, starting the whole process anew. Sometimes my father would help search too, as he also was not privy to the key's secret location. Eventually, each year, she'd start keeping it in her pocket at all times to protect the few remaining cookies. Those cookie hunts were rare moments when the four of us came together, without fighting, in pursuit of a common goal. Remembering these moments still makes me smile.
That was listener Tricia Hendricks from Baldwin. And now to our own Dennis Owsley. He has a story about a favorite holiday memory in Yellowstone National Park, and he has a very deep and memorable reflection.
In 1990, my late wife Rosa and I and our kids went to her sister's cabin in Bridger Canyon north of Bozeman, Montana for Christmas. It was a typical Montana winter. Lots of snow and temperatures of 40 degrees below zero every morning. It was interesting to feel my nose hairs freeze every time we went outside. The best thing happened on Christmas Eve day, when Rosa and I, our son and her sister, drove 3 hours each way to Mammoth Hot Springs in Yellowstone National Park. Yellowstone in winter is pristine wilderness. There is a lot of snow, great silence, and animals. And around the hot springs, there are fantastic natural ice sculptures. It was 30 degrees below zero with a bright cloudless sky. We walked all the trails through the magical ice sculptures of the hot springs and took many pictures to document what we had seen. Later, we drove toward the Lamar Valley, watching herds of elk and buffalo in their winter coats, watching how each species used their horns to clear the snow from the plants that they needed for survival. We saw a fox hunting for rodents under the snow. listening for movement and then diving headfirst into the snow to catch its prey. We saw more amazing ice sculptures on frozen waterfalls and on the Yellowstone River as it went through rapids. For me, nothing beats wilderness for bringing a sense of awe about nature and a calm realization of how fortunate we are to be able to experience these things. These moments are some of the best gifts I have ever had.
I'm sure there are very few people on this planet who aren't familiar with Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. It plays many, many times every year on television and on the radio, and in fact, it's going to be playing here on our station tomorrow. But we have an excerpt from A Christmas Carol now from Anne Williams, a storyteller from Kirkwood. She takes us to one of the more or less chilling elements in that particular story, and that would be the visit from the ghost of Christmas Past.
The bell sounded with a deep, dull, hollow, melancholy one. A light flashed up in the room upon the instant, and the curtains of his bed were drawn aside. The curtains of his bed were drawn aside, I tell you, by a hand, and Scrooge, starting up in a half-recumbent attitude, found himself face to face with the unearthly visitor that drew them. It was a strange figure, like a child, yet not so much like a child as like an old man viewed through some supernatural medium which made it appear receded from the view and diminished to child's proportion. The hair upon its head was white as if with age, but there was not a wrinkle upon its face, and the tenderest bloom was upon the skin. The arms were long and muscular, the hands the same, as if its hold were of uncommon strength. Its legs and feet were delicately formed, and like its upper members, bare. It wore a tunic of the purest white, and round its waist was bound a lustrous belt, the sheen of which was beautiful. It held a branch of green holly in its hand, and in singular contradiction to this wintry emblem, its dress was trimmed with summer flowers. But the strangest thing was that from the crown of its head sprung a pure, bright jet of light by which all this was made visible, and which was the occasion, no doubt, in duller moments, for the great extinguisher cap it carried beneath its arm. But as Scrooge looked upon it with increasing steadiness, this was not its strangest feature, for as the belt sparkled and glistened, now in one place and now in another, so that what at one moment was light was at another time dark, so the creature fluctuated in its distinctness, being now a thing with one arm, now with one leg, now with 20 legs, now a pair of legs without a head, and now a head without a body, of which each dissolving part no outline was visible in the dense gloom wherein it disappeared, and by the very wonder of it being itself whole and distinct again. Are you the spirit whose coming was foretold to me? I am. Its voice was soft and gentle, singularly low, as if instead of being close to me, it was at a distance. Who or what are you? Demanded Scrooge. I am the ghost of Christmas past. Long past, he asked, observing its diminished stature. No, your past. Perhaps Scrooge could not have explained it if anybody could have asked, but he had a special desire to see the spirit with its cap on, and begged it to be covered. What? Would you so soon put out with human hands the light I give? Is it not enough that you are one of those whose passions have made this cap and forced me to wear it through trains of years low upon my brow? Scrooge reverently disclaimed any intention to offend, and all knowledge of having bonneted the spirit through any period of its life. He then made bold to inquire as to what brought it there. Your welfare. Scrooge expressed himself as obliged, but could not help thinking that a good night's rest undisturbed would have proven more conducive to that end. The spirit must have heard his thoughts and added, Your reclamation, then, take heed. As it said these words, it put out a strong hand and clasped him by the arm. Rise and walk with me. Its grasp, though as gentle as a woman's hand, was not to be resisted. Scrooge rose, but seeing that the spirit made toward the window, he clasped its robe in supplication. But I am a mortal and liable to fall. Bear but a touch of my hand here, said the spirit, placing its hand upon his heart. And you shall be upheld in more things than this. As these words were spoken, they passed through the wall and found themselves on an open country road with fields on either side. The city had vanished completely, and it was a clear, cold winter day with snow upon the ground.
That was storyteller Anne Williams of Kirkwood as she read from Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, the segment on The Ghost of Christmas Past. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Welcome back to our special Christmas Eve broadcast of St. Louis on the Air. And now a Christmas classic that we're all certainly familiar with, A Visit from St. Nicholas, known by most of us as The Night Before Christmas, Clement Moore's classic for young and old alike. Members of our staff here at St. Louis Public Radio joined me in this reading. "'Twas the night before Christmas when all through the house not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. The stockings were hung by the chimney with care in hopes that St. Nicholas soon would be there.
The children were nestled, all snug in their beds, while visions of sugar plums danced in their heads, and Mama in her kerchief and I in my cap had just settled our brains for a long winter's nap.
When out on the lawn there arose such a clatter, I sprang from the bed to see what was the matter. Away to the window I flew like a flash, tore open the shutters, and threw up the sash.
The moon on the breast of the new-fallen snow gave the luster of midday to objects below, when what to my wondering eyes should appear but a miniature sleigh and 8 tiny reindeer.
With the little old driver so lively and quick, I knew in a moment it must be St. Nick. More rapid than eagles his coursers they came, and he whistled and shouted and called them by name.
Now Dasher, now Dancer, now Prancer and Vixen, on Comet, on Cupid, on Donner and Blitzen, to the top of the porch, to the top of the wall, now dash away, dash away, dash away all.
As dry leaves that before the wild hurricane fly, when they meet with an obstacle, mount to the sky. So up to the housetop, the coursers they flew, with the sleigh full of toys, and St. Nicholas too.
And then in a twinkling I heard on the roof the prancing and pawing of each little hoof. As I drew in my head and was turning around, down the chimney St. Nicholas came with a bound.
He was dressed all in fur from his head to his foot, and his clothes were all tarnished with ashes and soot. A bundle of toys he had flung on his back, and he looked like a peddler just opening his pack.
His eyes, how they twinkled, his dimples, how merry. His cheeks were like roses, his nose like a cherry. His droll little mouth was drawn up like a bow, and the beard of his chin was as white as the snow.
The stump of a pipe he held tight in his teeth, and the smoke, it encircled his head like a wreath. He had a broad face and a little round belly that shook when he laughed like a bowl full of jelly.
He was chubby and plump, a right jolly old elf, and I laughed when I saw him in spite of myself. A wink of his eye and a twist of his head soon gave me to know I had nothing to dread.
He spoke not a word, but went straight to his work and filled all the stockings, then turned with a jerk and laying his finger aside of his nose and giving a nod, up the chimney he rose.
He sprang to his sleigh, to his team gave a whistle, and away they all flew like the down of a thistle. But I heard him exclaim ere he drove out of sight, "Happy Christmas to all, and to all a good night."
The staff of St. Louis Public Radio. We asked our listeners if they would help us out by sending to us via Facebook or Twitter or by any means in use these days of their own favorite Christmas memories. And one John Weber sent one. And I think many of people of a certain age will remember doing this. Remember the old Famous and Bar downtown? Some people call it Famous and Bar and some people call it Famous Bar. John Weber writes, "Looking at the windows at Famous and Bar, going upstairs to see the huge Santa display, then eating dinner at the St. Louis Room. It was quite an event. We put on our Sunday best and everything. I still may have one of the gifts they handed out after I sat on Santa's lap." And then we had Hannah Shanks, who wrote to us through Facebook again. Every Christmas Eve of my life, I have been in a candlelit service that begins at 11 p.m. and ends at midnight, first in my home in Illinois and now at my church in St. Louis. At the close of the service, we sing through Silent Night as we light candles throughout the congregation, raising them above our heads on the final verse. Usually, during this verse, bells start tolling midnight. Then we turn to one another and wish each other the very first Merry Christmas of the day. It is simple, but beautiful and moving. And now we turn back once again to some of the Christmas memories of staffers here at St. Louis Public Radio. Kristen Radican has a story about a 12-year-old gift-giving tradition between sisters and mother of exchanging an ugly Christmas decoration.
In 2000, my first year away at college, my sister was living in St. Charles, and I came to stay with her during the holiday break. One day, we went to my mom's house to help her decorate for Christmas. While we were there, she brought out a box of decorations she found in the basement. And inside the box was a faded, ugly, orange felt boot. It's about 3 inches tall, and it fits in the palm of your hand. It's got a fur cuff lining, strange netting on the inside, and a brass bell with a tiny gold bow, all held in place with a piece of green pipe cleaner. None of us had any idea where it came from. We told her it was ugly, and we didn't want it, but she kept insisting we take it. We finally took it out of the box to take a good look, and firmly said we didn't want it. But when we got back to my sister's house, much to our surprise, we found that ugly orange felt boot. So now, every year, we hide the ugly Christmas boot. And whoever ends up with the boot on Christmas has to keep it until the next year. One year, we tied it to our mom's dog's collar. Another time, we wrapped it up extravagantly and presented it as a gift. We've mailed it back and forth to each other from Portland to Phoenix and back to St. Louis. It's been hidden and packed in suitcases. And last year, my sister hid it on my Christmas tree. This year, it's my turn to sneak the Christmas boot to someone, and I've got it all planned out. I don't want to give it away, but I'm making homemade gifts this year, and it may have something to do with that. My mom hasn't gotten it for a few years, so I think it might be her turn.
That's Kristen Radican of St. Louis Public Radio. Now to Martha Wegman of the same company. She has a series of favorite gifts of receiving 90s and begging to open them not on Christmas morning, but early on Christmas Eve.
Growing up, my mom made my sisters and me Christmas nightgowns, or 90s. It is one of my fondest holiday memories. As a child, I would go to sleep to the whirring of her sewing machine, along with the smell of cookies baking. That would fuel my already giddy anticipation for what was to come. The 90s were her original design, flannel, and then embellished with her artistic hand. Once, I remember, they were white with green rickrack Christmas trees, and one year they were red with white fur trim. I'm the youngest of four daughters, and I remember pestering my mom on Christmas Eve. We wanted to open just one gift instead of waiting until Christmas morning. She would put us off with feigned annoyance, then finally relent, and we would open the cherished hand-sewn 90s we knew she had made. Old family movies capture the four of us being silly, dancing, laughing soundlessly, gleefully anticipating Santa's arrival. Later, when we had children of our own, the tradition continued. My mom made nightshirts for our sons. I don't think she knew how to make something that didn't look like a 90. In Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, he writes of one character that, quote, he knew how to keep Christmas well if any man alive possessed the knowledge. May that be said of us and all of us. That quote makes me think of my mom. She knew how to keep Christmas well.
Martha Wegman of St. Louis Public Radio.
Hark, how the bells, sweet silver bells, all seem to say, "Folk is away, Christmas is here, bringing good cheer to young and old, meek and the bold. Ding dong, ding dong, there is a song, with joyful ring, all caroling.
Cheery, ringing, from everywhere, spring the air. Oh, 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 gaily they ring, while people sing songs of good cheer. Christmas is here,
merry, 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 merry Christmas.
Merry, 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 merry Christmas. On they send, on without end, their joyful tone to every home.
Hark how the bells, sweet silver bells, all seem to say, throw cares away.
Christmas is here, bringing good cheer to young and old, meek and the bold.
Ding dong, ding dong,
that is the song. Ding dong, ding dong,
all caroling.
One seems to hear words of good cheer from everywhere, filling the air.
Oh, the bell, raising the song, nor hear the bell, telling the cheer.
Gaily they ring, while people sing songs of good cheer.
Christmas is here.
Merry, merry, merry Christmas.
Merry, 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 merry Christmas.
On they send, on without end, their joyful tone to every home.
Hark how the bells, sweet silver bells, all seem to say, throw cares away.
Ding dong, ding dong,
ding dong, ding dong.
This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our Christmas Eve presentation of St. Louis on the Air. This is the part of the program where we go to you for holiday memories. Now we have another Christmas memory from one of our listeners, Jim Daniels. He lives in St. Charles, and he has a story about a tradition he is starting with his young son.
My wife and I have sat down with our four-year-old son to explain the importance of giving during the holiday season. In a time where it seems that wanting takes precedence over everything else, our son is beginning to experience the joys of giving to those who may not be as fortunate as he is. Starting this year, we have asked our son to select 10 of his toys to give to other children in need. On Christmas Eve, he will place these 10 toys in a large bag for Santa to take with him to give to other children. Ben has been busy going through his toy box, picking various cars, books, puzzles, and action figures to give to the other kids. These toys are not broken or missing parts. They are not dented or scratched. They are what our son considers to be cool toys that others will enjoy just as much as he did. This idea of giving has really taken off, with Ben anticipating the joy that his generosity will provide for those in need. We are also expecting a daughter in April. Ben is already talking to his baby sissy, still in mommy's tummy, instilling this important life lesson of giving.
Well, that would certainly seem to put the Christmas holiday in some perspective, wouldn't it? You know, that's something that I tried to do several years ago when I wrote a poem called The Day After Christmas. We've aired it on this Christmas holiday season before here at St. Louis Public Radio, and oftentimes people have asked if we would do it again, so we're going to try it one more time. This is the story that came about because one Christmas, a good many years ago, our family was gathered together, and in the living room, after opening all the presents and amid all the debris and the ribbons and the boxes and all the rest of it, one of the youngsters, who was very young at the time, looked up and said, "Is that all there is? Is there nothing more for us?" And that got me to thinking, just as our friend from St. Charles, Jim Daniels, did, that youngsters should really have a greater perspective on what this holiday was all about. So I sat down and took a little time and wrote The Day After Christmas. Boxes piled high and ribbons askew, pretty paper that once had been new. The tree in the corner, the lights now turned out, the room otherwise empty, no children about. The toys they had scattered amid the debris were left to themselves, except two or three which the youngsters had taken as favorite treasures upstairs to their rooms for their own private pleasures. For mother and father, a chance to relax before putting the paper in cartons and stacks. The parents were happy with all they had done. The children tore through it, all in great fun. And if the measure of Christmas is the size of the mess, then this day indeed could be called a success. For the daughter of eight, there'd been memories born she'd carry forever of this Christmas morn. But up in his room, midst his robots and such, a boy of just 10 thought he'd not gotten much. Not enough, anyway. Not all he'd demanded and all of those appeals to Mom, Dad, and Santa. There were things that he had wanted not under the tree, so Christmas for him was not all it could be. He'd gotten his games and electronic things, well-batteried monsters with loud buzzers and pings, a Swiss Army knife, cowboy boots, and a sweater. But the little boy, Johnny, thought he should have done better. So he moped in his room and felt downright sad, even felt angry with Mom, Santa, and Dad. And speaking of Santa, now Johnny believed that over the years he'd been greatly deceived, for if Santa existed, that would have been that. He'd have gotten that TV and real cowboy hat. But no TV or hat were placed under the tree. The gifts he most wanted were just not to be. He told all who would listen what rang tops on his list. How was it possible they had been missed? So he sat in his room with ambitions unmet and forgot all about all he did get. He grew sullen and angry and frustrated too. He pouted and blamed and felt terribly blue. He thought back on the morning and this day he anointed, the worst Christmas of all. He was most disappointed. With the family at dinner, he was hard-pressed to conceal it, that feeling he had, but he wouldn't reveal it. Mom looked at Dad and one to the other. Even his sister wondered about brother. But he sat there in silence and said not a word. His father, impatient, thought this was absurd. It's Christmas, he thought, and Johnny's done well. What in the world could be causing this spell? He asked, "What's wrong, son? Not feeling so hot?" But Johnny just shifted. He'd been put on the spot. He pushed at his food, dinner hardly completed, and he knew Dad's question would soon be repeated. He didn't wait long. Dad spelled it right out. "Come on, Johnny," he said. "What's this all about?" So he put down his fork, and like a dam burst, he blurted to all, "This day's been the worst." Dad looked at Mom and the little girl, too, and no one knew quite what to do. The heat swelled in Johnny, red covered his face. He wished none of this day had in fact taken place. He'd said what he said, and he knew he'd regret it, and he wished beyond wish that all might forget it. But the next words were Dad's, measured and strong. "Johnny," he said, "what in God's name is wrong?" His words cut like a pin, stabbing a bubble. Johnny knew that his future held nothing but trouble. He took a deep breath. He took all the strength that he had. But he had to explain why this day was so bad. The string of his words was for moments unbroken. No one at the table could believe what was spoken. A 10-year-old boy with a room full of toys, the envy of most of the world's girls and boys, sat there full blushing in an obvious huff, and he told them quite clearly he'd not gotten enough. His father sat silent. His mother did too. Johnny shifted uneasily, wondering what they would do. He could see their unhappiness, their deep disappointment. In a voice like a whisper, Dad said, We have an appointment. I'm sorry, my boy, you feel so let down, but tomorrow at 9, we're going downtown. You must learn about Christmas, that it's not all receiving, that Christmas is love, it's giving, believing. You've been misdirected, and it saddens me, son. Perhaps it's the job your mother and I've done. You have more than most, and today you got more. I'm tempted to take it all back to the store. You're missing the point, son, about what this day's about. Tomorrow at 9, you and I will go out. No more was said. Dinner ended in gloom, and Johnny was happy to slink to his room. He knew Dad was angry, that Mother was sad, and he knew very clearly that he had been bad. He slowly undressed, complete in his sorrow, and he wondered what Dad had in mind for tomorrow. Sleep didn't come easily. He tossed and he dreamed, but morning came quickly, too quickly it seemed. He woke, washed and dressed, and ate with the rest, and if pressed, would have gladly confessed that it was wrong what he'd said. He'd not used his head. He honestly wished at one point he were dead. The minutes passed slowly, and the clock on the wall showed no indication of movement, no, none at all. His father said little as he buttered his toasts, and Mom was more silent on this day than most. It was an awful wait for a fateful date, and if time moved at all, it was slow. But the agony ended, suspense was suspended, when Dad turned to him saying, "Let's go." The snow squeaked neath their boots as they walked to the car. Johnny was glad that the walk wasn't far. When they pulled out in the street, he saw it was snowing, but he hadn't a clue as to where they were going. They drove mostly in silence. Not 10 words were spoken, and the little boy's wondering only was broken when Dad parked on a parking lot being cleared of the snow. Only then was it clear as to where they would go. The hospital. But why? His curiosity heightened. Then the feeling he had was the feeling of frightened. He'd seen this building before, but he'd not been inside. He knew sick people went there, and that some sometimes died. They walked from the car and approached the front door. An ambulance passed with a wail and a roar. Now Johnny was worried and wished he could run. Run from his father and what Dad thought must be done. A few seconds later, they stood square in the lobby. Johnny's knees shook. They felt rubbery and knobby. He stared at the floor and wished he could holler. His father stood by and brushed snow from his collar. The flakes fluttered downward, gently striking the tile, and became tiny puddles in a very short while. But Johnny just stared, eyes fixed, pointed down. They soon focused on shoes, a pair, shiny and brown. His eyes slid slowly upward till they fixed on a face. He thought he'd be frightened, but that wasn't the case. His father was watching, then said, "Johnny, I think that it's time that you met the good Dr. Frink." Frink's eyes didn't smile as he looked at the lad. Johnny was sure Frink knew he'd been bad, but he stuck out his hand, as he'd been taught was just right, and he hoped that this stranger thought he was polite. Frink's eyes caught the father's as if he wanted to smile. His expression told Dad that he liked the boy's style, but Johnny was bashful and he didn't see. And he visibly jumped when Frink said, "Come with me." He looked at his father and Dad nodded yes, though where they were going was anyone's guess. But the doctor and Dad, they certainly knew what lay ahead, what they all soon would do. They walked as a threesome down the long winding halls, up some stairs, through big doors, past spotless white walls. After 10 minutes or so, when they'd walked very far, Frink said, "Johnny, do you have any idea how lucky you are? Even with Christmas that turned out so bad, it was better by far than the one my kids had. Some are quite sick and in a very bad way. Christmas for them was just one more day. Most got nice presents, shiny and new, and in a moment you'll meet one or two. But none of them got what they really had sought, because what they wanted just can't be bought." The words fell on Johnny like blows from a hammer. He wanted to talk, but he knew he'd just stammer. He looked at the doctor, his dad, Frink again. If he'd been more nervous before, he didn't know when. He could sense what was coming. He could feel the alarm. And it was at this very moment that he realized the harm and the hurt his selfishness brought, the first part of the lesson he was about to be taught. Dad put his hand on his shoulder and squeezed once or twice, and Johnny would always remember how it felt awfully nice as a gesture of confidence for one nearing his doom, and it helped as the three of them entered a room. As they stepped through the door, he hesitated a fraction, for there was a girl strapped and in traction. Her leg was held high by long wires and bars. Her secret concern was that there would be scars. For Jenny, her name was, had come to believe that her dreams of the dance were dashed Christmas Eve. A fall in her house in an unusual way had caused her a terrible Christmas day. She was the same age as Johnny, a girl about 10, but even at that age, yes, even then, dreams of dancing on stage, film, or TV had gone to the land of might never be. During the visit, it was never made plain that she was entertaining the trio in a great deal of pain, but she smiled at her doctor, at Johnny, and Dad, and said that she didn't feel all that bad. They chatted a while and joked with good cheer, and she was the first to wish Happy New Year. As they left, she watched Johnny with the look of a gnome. "You're so lucky," she said, "to have had Christmas at home." "I know," he admitted as he pressed his dad's hand, "but you'll soon be home, and it'll be grand." They waved through the door and re-entered the hall, and Johnny lamented that she'd had that bad fall. "She'll be here for weeks," said Frank as they talked. "Very bad luck," said Dad while they walked. In a few minutes' time, at a door open wide, they heard lusty laughter quite clearly inside. The doctor entered, breaking out a wide grin. The response was immediate, of course. "Come in." They did as was bid and all stepped to the bed. There, surrounded by pillows propped under his head, was a boy known as Billy, who hailed from a farm. And to see him and think, there's no cause for alarm. But Johnny knew better. The boy had to be ill. And as if on a signal, Bill was handed a pill. He was quite sick, though you'd be hard-pressed to know it, because neither he nor his family in any way showed it. They laughed and they shouted, and throughout the confusion, there was no way Johnny could tell. It was all an illusion, no hint whatsoever, that to cure Billy's affliction would take the doctor's best work and divine interdiction. Johnny and Billy talked about the things that boys do, about football and hockey, sports they both knew. The moments passed quickly and the family joined in. People passing the doorway were impressed by the din. When the doctor achieved what he hoped to achieve, he touched the boy's shoulder, saying it was time to leave. They left the room trailed by cheers of the season, and if you'd been there, you'd have thought there's no reason to worry or fret about the gang down the hall. No reason to worry, no reason at all. But the doctor explained as they walked briskly away that Billy might never again be able to play. He'd be lucky to do anything ever with ease, for he suffered a terrible, life-threatening disease. And, Frank revealed, Billy's gift Christmas Day was word that extended his hospital stay. Frank bent down to Johnny, nose to nose, toe to toe. "Johnny, there's something I think you should know. Billy had just one Christmas request," he softly said, "never to return to his hospital bed. He didn't want toys, a football, or paint, just the chance to end a lifelong complaint and be healthy and strong like any young boy, a chance to live life that most people enjoy. That's all he wanted for Christmas, but he'll never get it. His family and I will always regret it. Some things, Johnny, you'll learn just aren't meant to be. And as a doctor, it always has bothered me. I can give comfort and medicine and at times reassure them, but one thing I can't do, I simply can't cure him." "But he was laughing," said Johnny. "His family was, too." "At this point in his life, it can't be easy to do," said the doctor, now upset and distressed. "In spite of it all, young Billy's been blessed. He's a giver of joy, a fine little boy. His family is wonderful, too. They have each other, kids, father and mother. Loving, in fact, is now all they can do. They have love of family and prayers on their side, but with a sickness like Billy's, there's no place to hide. So they take life as it's given, laughter and pain, and I've never heard one of them ever complain." Johnny nodded at Dad. A tear slipped from his eye. He now understood clearly that Billy might die. Can I give him my presents? Can I give him my toys? Can I do anything for him? He's the nicest of boys. Johnny was desperate, wanted badly to give. He wanted to do something to help Billy live. Or if that was impossible, to help make life more pleasant, he'd gladly turn over his each Christmas present. Frink looked at the father and gave him a nod. The boys learned something today, and we can thank God. A hard lesson, my son, Dad said with a smile, one we all need to remember once in a while. Frink had planned other visits as part of the tour, but the point had been made, the response had been pure. There are more children here, some worse and some better, and Frink asked, what about Jenny? Did you forget her? No, I haven't, said Johnny. Can't I help her some, too? Dad said, I have an idea, son, but it'll be up to you. Take some of your toys you have all in creation and consider making some kind of donation. The sick youngsters here, some are quite needy. To have all that you have almost seems greedy. For some of the kids here, a little pleasure or laughter is all they can hope for. It's all that they're after. But it's up to you, Johnny. Do what you think best. Dr. Frink and I can take care of the rest. By now, Johnny's face was awash with his tears, for he had learned something today beyond his 10 years, a lesson in life that some never see. Some things can't be placed neath the Christmas tree. Unlike computers or hats or baseball bats, some things can't be purchased by power or wealth. As Johnny now knows, and as you might suppose, the most precious of gifts are love, life, and good health. That's a poem I wrote several years ago, reflecting on the day after Christmas, which is sometimes as interesting as Christmas Day itself, especially when young relatives are not happy with the gifts that they had received. Tomorrow at this time, you can enjoy a holiday special from NPR, Jonathan Winter's reading of A Christmas Carol, hosted by Susan Stamberg. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thanks for listening. I'm Don Marsh, and we wish you a very Merry Christmas. This is St. Louis on the Air.